Right. Okay, thank you. So there is a handout for this. Right? Yep. Right, okay. Good afternoon. And we're going to try to explore Maimonides on creation. Now, that should seem to be a fairly simple issue. What's there to explore? After all, we have the 13 principles of faith, which you can see at the beginning of your handout. The popular version, which is the sort of one-liner or one-and-a-half line per principle, first printed in the Venice Haggadah of 1566, and a few years later, the Krakow Prayer Book, 1596. Well, the very first of these 13 principles of faith says, I believe with complete faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, is the Creator and guide of all created beings. He alone has made, does make, and will make all things. Then if you look at number four, I believe with complete faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, is the first and the last. Well, the first means He comes before everything. So there you have it. God is before everything. God exists before everything. And God creates everything there is. End of story. Fits with Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Well, there doesn't seem to be any problem there. There, no problem. And in fact, the Yigdal poem, written a little bit earlier, said to have been written by Daniel ben Judah in 14th century Rome. So that's based on the 13 principles. So the first one, the first line says, Nimtza ve'ein eit el metziyoto. He exists unbounded by time in his existence. And the fourth line, corresponding, each line of Yigdal corresponds to one of the 13 principles. Kadmon l'chol davar asher nivra, rishon ve'ein reshit l'reshito. He preceded every being that was created. He's the first. Nothing preceded his precedence. Okay, the only problem is these are popular versions of the 13 principles of faith, and they were not written by Maimonides himself. So now we're going to look at the actual text of the 13 principles of faith from his commentary on the Mishnah. Now that he wrote the commentary on the Mishnah, it was complete, and so to speak, published, or obviously in manuscript form, but it was published in 1168. Would you like to read this number one, to believe? So you understand, the 13 principles of faith originally are part of the commentary on the Mishnah. On the section in Sanhedrin, Mishnah Tractate Sanhedrin, the chapter which begins, Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek l'olam haba, or every Jew has a portion in the world to come. And then, a little bit later, it goes on and says, these are the people who don't get a portion in the world to come, and it gives a list of false beliefs. So this raises the whole question of what are the true beliefs. So it's in that context, commenting on that Mishnah as an introduction to that chapter in the Mishnah, that the Rambam compiled his 13 principles of faith. Now, if you would like to read the... you're passing it on. Okay.
To believe in the existence of the Creator, that there is an existent... complete in all the senses of the word existence. He is the cause of all existence. In him, all else subsists, and from him derives. It is inconceivable that he does not exist, for should he not exist, the existence of all else would be extinguished, and nothing could persist. If we imagine the absence of any other existent thing, however, God's existence would not thereby be extinguished nor diminished. For unity and mastery are only God's, since he is sufficient to himself. All else, whether angels or celestials, and whatever is in them or below them, needs him to exist. This first fundamental principle is taught in the biblical verse, I am the Lord your God.
Right, now this is a very interesting passage. Thank you for reading it. Does it actually say that he created everything? Does it?
He says he is the cause of all existence.
Yes, and it sort of implies that he's the creator, that he created everything, because it refers to him as the creator.
Hmm. Right at the beginning.
Yeah.
To believe in the existence of the creator. That's absolutely true. The way that the text continues emphasizes not so much that he created everything at a particular moment, but that he is continuously necessary in order for anything to go on existing, which is a very interesting idea, that he's taking it beyond the simple idea that God created everything at a certain point in time, full stop. But that in order for anything to exist now, it needs some kind of input from the divine. And it looks, but most of what he's saying, it's inconceivable that he does not exist, for he should he not exist, the existence of all else would be extinguished. You know, it's almost as if you said, if God were, you know, so to speak, suddenly to disappear, nothing would be there. Nothing else would be there. So there is some kind of input coming from the divine which is making everything else exist. That seems to be the focus. Now, he does say it's the cause, and he does say the creator in the first line. We have to remember that this is translated from the Arabic. And the best current translation is that by Kaffa, or the different ways of pronouncing his name. In the rabbinic world, it's called Kapach, but I think Kaffa or Kafi is closer to the Arabic, authentic Arabic name that he has. He uses the word Bore, he uses the word creator. Here at the beginning. So that does... He's translating the Arabic into Hebrew, but he uses that Hebrew word.
It says, though, and nothing, without him, nothing could persist.
Yes.
So, your point about Maimonides' point, that he has to continue to exist.
Yes, he has to continue to exist in order for everything else to exist. Yes. Yeah.
I think on one level, we should not take for granted the meaning of the word creator. And it could be that when at the beginning, at least in the English, the word creator comes along, be interpreted by what follows. What does it mean that he is a creator? He called the cause of all existence. All existence needs him to exist. Maybe that is indeed the meaning of creator. It's not that we should have a concept, we should not necessarily import the preconceived notion of create.
So you're saying that don't attribute our conventional concept of creator to this term. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, if we even have a conventional concept, I don't know if we do.
Okay.
But, I think our conventional concept comes from the first verse of Bereshit, Bereshit bara,
which itself is very...
Bereshit bara. The emphasis on the first word, Bereshit, in the beginning. That's our conventional
I don't want to digress here, because I feel almost in the middle of this presentation, but that the meaning of that verse is very obscure.
Okay. All right. Now let's look at number four. We are to believe, would you like to add a point down to read this, please?
Yes, we are to believe that the One is absolutely eternal, nothing
no thing existed before him, as many scriptural verses prove. This fourth fundamental principle is taught in the biblical verse. Me'ane Elokei.
Mo'ona Elokei Kedem.
Our dwelling place is the eternal God.
Right. Now that's all that the fourth principle says in the normal printed version of Maimonides' 13 Principles of Faith in his commentary on the Mishnah. Now what we're going to find, you see this is written, the order of his writings is that first of all he wrote the commentary on the Mishnah, then he wrote Mishneh Torah, his mammoth reformulation of Talmudic law, and then he wrote Guide for the Perplexed, and then we're going to see, hopefully, that he came back to the commentary on the Mishnah and to this fourth principle, and he added a footnote. This whole lecture is in order to understand that footnote. Okay. Okay, right. Which I didn't find myself. Kapach Kafa found it, wrote it down in his edition of the commentary on the Mishnah, and various scholars such as Davidson and others have since, Mark Shapiro, have since commented on that, Davidson in particular. All right. Now just for, if we turn over the page, just for completion, I've added there the other of the principles of faith. Now, I must point out that, for example, Sadia Gaon, who also wrote a kind of a list of basic principles of faith before Maimonides, had the creation of the world very clearly as one of those principles of faith. All right? So Maimonides is... It could be that this is exactly... that this is about creation in the normal sense of the word, but we will find not everyone understood it in that way. Let's now move to his Mishneh Torah, completed in 1178. Okay, so that's 10 years later. We've got his beautiful, huge work completed in 1178. There's a campaign by the Lubavitcher Rebbe that people should study 3 chapters a day of this work, and there are about 1,000, or there are 1,000 chapters, so that means that in a year you go through the whole of the Oral Torah, all the laws of the Oral Torah, and the 34th cycle of that study is just beginning. Alright, so here we have Mishneh Torah, Laws of the Foundation of the Torah. We got chapter 1, number 1. Right, Sam, would you like to take that?
The foundation of all foundations and the pillar of wisdom is to know that there is a primary being who brings Mansi, all existence, into being. All the entities in the heavens, the earth, and what between them came into existence only from the truth of his being, La Nisano Ella Me'amitat Himsil.
Right, thank you very much. So there we know that there's a primary being which brings all existence into being. Now, I put the Hebrew, Mamtzi. Mishneh Torah was written in Hebrew, not Arabic. So it's written in Hebrew, and it says Mamtzi. Is Mamtzi in the past or in the present?
The present.
The present. We would normally translate Mamtzi as a present tense verb. So it's not saying he brought everything into existence. He brings it into existence. It fits with what we saw before, that existence continuously depends on him. Now, would you like to say the next one as well, please?
Sure. If one would imagine that he does not exist, no other being could possibly exist.
Right, so there we have the same idea that we had. And then in number 3, we've got the idea that if all existence disappeared, there would just be God alone. That's number 3. Now we come Number four is referring to various verses. Number five is where we have a philosophical explanation of the relationship of God to the universe. Okay, would you like to take that? Number five, this entity.
This entity is the God of the world and the Lord of the entire earth. He controls the sphere with infinite and unbounded power. This power continues without interruption because the sphere is constantly revolving, and it is impossible for it to revolve without it being caused to revolve. It is He, blessed be He, who causes it to revolve without a hand or any other corporeal aspect.
Right, so there we have, we're looking at the Aristotelian view of the world, that you have spheres, and the ninth sphere is the outer sphere, which is going round and causing all the other spheres to go round. And God is the prime mover, which is making that happen in a wonderful way, without a hand, without a body, nonetheless, somehow or other, He's making it happen. But it doesn't say He created the outer sphere. It's saying He's making the outer sphere go round. Now, many Jewish scholars accepted the idea that these texts fully accord with Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, right? They didn't see any of the little problems that we have been looking at here. Thousands of people are going to be studying around the world this passage tomorrow in this 34th cycle of studying the Rambam, Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. Not one of them is going to think that this is anything different to in the beginning God created heaven and earth, okay? But here in the rarefied atmosphere of Oxford, we can look at it in a slightly different way. Yes, Sam?
I mean, that might have been the Aristotelian view of God, but I mean, when Newton came along with a rather different picture, like Newton's first law is essentially explains why the world spins, I think, because there's no external force at all. The world continues to spin. So, I mean, if it's interesting, Rambam is basing his ideas on Greek philosophy. Like Aristotle was good at many things, but like he got a lot of science wrong. And is it possible that Rambam also like got scientific concepts?
Well, we have to sort of fit into the fact that that Maimonides is using the Aristotelian scientific view of the world in order to describe things. Someone once presented the view that all Jewish thought will take the scientific thought of its time and will illuminate that in one way or the other. That's so.
It could be absolutely, as in relatively, it could be enlightening, but like absolutely.
Well, so some people would say that since these descriptions have become part of the Torah in the fact that Maimonides wrote them down, they are now part of the Torah corpus and so are now have a certain eternity beyond Aristotle himself and his ideas. So you know, which means reinterpreting them in all kinds of different ways. The Lubavitcher Rebbe would discuss, you know, someone once asked the Rebbe, what are the four elements, which are a crucial issue in Aristotelian thought, and through that have entered Jewish thought in general. So he said, matter, positive, negative, matter, and antimatter. In other words, he translated the four elements into the scientific language of his time. So that's an ongoing process. All right, now, however, Rabbi Joseph Albo, living in Spain, 1380 to 1444, he did not see the Rambam in the text that we've been discussing as making the belief in the creation of the world a fundamental principle of Judaism, particularly in the 13 principles of faith. Now, he himself didn't think that belief in creation was a fundamental principle, and this is an interesting aspect that we have from the time of Chasdai Crescas, who is 1340 to 1412, living after Maimonides, a century and a half later. he criticizes the 13 principles. He says, look, you can't say that all these 13 principles you must believe in and they are absolutely fundamental to Judaism. There are positive beliefs, which it's a good thing for people to believe in, and there are fundamental beliefs. But the fundamental beliefs are much smaller, a smaller number. Now, Albo follows suit. He goes, he's living later, and here, a generation later, he follows Chasdai Kreskes' view, and he has the idea that there are only three fundamental beliefs: the existence of God, reward and punishment, the divine origin of the Torah. Now, those three are part of the 13 of Maimonides' 13 principles of faith. But to Albo, creation is a good thing to believe. You should believe it. But if you don't, you're still part of the Jewish people. It's, and Judaism won't disappear if you didn't believe in creation. So, so we've got this quote from him. Ellen, would you like to read creation ex nihilo? You see that with Albo on the next page? No, it's double-sided. Thanks to HP.
Creation ex nihilo is a dogma which everyone who professes a divine law is obliged to believe. In the same way as he who professes the law of Moses is obliged to believe that the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up Korach and his congregation because they rebelled against Moses. But it is not one of the fundamental principles of divine law, whose existence cannot be conceived without it.
Right. So in other words, he's presenting the idea that, yeah, creation's a good thing to believe, and if a believing person reads the Torah, reads all these different miracles, the earth opened up and swallowed Korach, Moses hit the rock, water came out of it. A believing person believes that. And but if he doesn't, or it doesn't mean that the whole foundation of Judaism is God. On the other hand, you couldn't have Judaism without the concept of God, right? Reconstructionists might disagree. but that's how Albo saw it in the very fraught atmosphere in the 15th century. He was the defender of Judaism in the dispute of Tortosa, which went on for over a year. So he lived through a very lived at a very critical time. Now Alba goes on talking about the difference between the different ways of thinking about the world. Obviously, the Torah expresses itself in the beginning. God created heaven and earth. There was nothing before there, leaving aside Israel's comments, you know, that there are different ways to understand it. Let's just take it very simply. There was nothing. There's creation ex nihilo, yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. God created everything. There was nothing, no time before then, just God, and then God creates the whole universe. Aristotle presents the view, lahavdil, that there was always existence, eternity, right? This beautiful Greek eternity, you know, stretching back into the infinite past and stretching forward into the infinite future. And the Greek drama, you know, takes place in this on this eternal stage. By contrast, Jewish drama is very, it's all very tight. So as far as Maimonides himself, and as Albo makes the case here, if you believe in the eternity of the world, like Aristotle, the whole Torah falls to the ground. But you might believe that there's an eternal primary matter which from which the world was created. So in other words, that there's something which exists contiguous with God, and God fashions that into the universe. Now, Albo thinks that that is a possible position. Most people wouldn't say so today in terms of their understanding of what Judaism is about, especially since science has moved on. So science has caught up with Genesis and now says there was a big bang. Everything began at some point. Whereas in the time of Aristotle, in the time of the thinkers we're talking about here, Aristotle was the known science. Yes?
It seems to me Robert's hair splitting here as to whether the universe has, in a sense, always existed and God then fashioned it, or whether God created it all and then, in effect, fashioned it. What difference does it actually make?
That's an extremely good point. The way that it was understood by these medieval sages is that from the Aristotelian point of view, miracles are impossible. From the Aristotelian point of view, existence and nature are absolutely set in stone. That cannot change in any way. Whereas from the second point of view, that there is some kind of existence which God suddenly wills into fashions it into the universe, so he can fashion into the universe in this way or in that way, and he can make the Red Sea split, and he can make the water come from the stone, and all the other miracles in the Torah, including the revival of the dead. All is within the hands of heaven to do whatever God wants. Whereas the Aristotelian position is seen as a completely static position. So that's the effect. That's the way they understood the effect.
Was Aristotle then an atheist?
Well, he believed in the prime mover. So there is a sense in which he did believe in God. But he didn't see God as a force which changes nature. But nonetheless, he believed that there is a prime mover, and the contemplation of the prime mover is an important aspect of life. Now, however, Albo does recognize that from the point of view of the Rambam, of Maimonides, if someone doesn't believe in creation, even though he doesn't put it in the 13 principles of faith, he has a list of who are considered heretics. That's in the next paragraph, but we're not going to read it. But he says there that if someone doesn't believe in creation, he is counted among a particular kind of heretic, min. But nonetheless, if we looked at that list and the other lists he had, we find that all kinds of people would somehow or other, unfortunately, fit into those lists in one way or the other. Now, but you've got Albo's double think, you know, the idea that what is a real fundament of Judaism and what is something which is a preferred a belief, even if someone doesn't, not everyone has it. Also, when we have Maimonides describing Abraham discovering the concept of God, which is a very beautiful passage, he realized, would you like to read this, please?
No.
Yeah? Yeah, Maimonides describes Abraham discovering the concept of God. Abraham was brought up among idolaters. And then he realized, do you see that? Halfway down the page 3. He realized?
Yeah, Maimonides describes Abraham discovering the concept of God.
Yeah.
He realized that there was one God who controlled the sphere, that he created everything, a cold bara. And that there is no other God at all.
Right. So therefore, God created everything. That's in Mishneh Torah. Okay, that is in the popular exoteric work of Jewish law. We now turn briefly to Guide for the Perplexed. And we look there. This is written in 1190, completed in 1190. Here Maimonides is bringing different proofs for the existence of God. He seemingly, not really, but he pretends, so to speak, to adopt Aristotle's view that the world is, that the universe is eternal. Accordingly, would you like to read it? Accordingly.
Yes, accordingly. If the motion in question is perpetual and eternal, as is stated by our adversary, it follows necessarily that the first cause of the movement of the sphere is separate from the sphere.
Right, so here he's proving the existence of God. Now we've got the idea that the sphere is moving eternally. So that means there's something infinite about it, because it's moving infinitely. What can move the sphere infinitely? It must be an infinite power beyond the sphere. That power is the prime mover, is God. So it's in this way that he's establishing the existence of God. But he's using the concept, and it's very interesting that he uses the word our adversary. Tapfach, in his Hebrew translation from the Arabic of Guide for the Perplexed, he writes Yerivenu, our adversary. It's a good translation, but it means Aristotle. So Aristotle, our adversary, presents the view that the motion of the sphere is eternal, that it wasn't created, it's an eternal thing, and since there was the sphere is moving with an eternal force, there must be a prime mover with infinite power moving it, and that is God. You want to make a comment, Sam?
Well, I was going to say that, as I stated before, according to Newton's first law.
Sure, sure. We're in the context of medieval science, and we're trying to understand the way these thinkers, looking at medieval science, looked at existence. How you read the existence of God now actually fits quite well with the first statement that Maimonides said. Nothing can exist without God. So take away all spheres, movement, prime movers, everything like that. Just the existence of matter is dependent on God. And a very interesting text which explains that is written by Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi in the end of the 18th century, the second section of Tanya, Gate of Unity and Faith, talks about the way that matter itself is dependent on a divine flow, keeping it in existence. So that goes completely beyond the Aristotelian framework. Now, Albo, it's...
All he's pointing out here is who is moving the sphere. He's not dealing with the existence of God here. He's just dealing with the relationship between God and what goes on in the universe. So this is a separate issue, really.
Yeah, but from the point of view of the guide 2.1, he's trying to prove the existence of God, and he uses four proofs, and this is the first of them. Now, it's interesting, the critique that Albo writes about this proof for the existence of God. Do you like to, Sam, since this proof? The bottom of page 3.
Last
paragraph.
Concerning. Since this proof is built on the idea of constant eternal motion, as the philosopher Aristotle assumes, and this is something which no member of the divine religion believing in creation can accept, he's not going to discuss it at all.
Right, an interesting thing. So Albert doesn't like the whole idea of this. Now, there was a person called Lipschitz, Gedalia Lipschitz, who wrote a commentary on Albo's Ikarim that we've been quoting. This book by Albo, the Ikarim means roots or principles of Judaism. And Gedalia Lipschitz, living in the 16th century, wrote a comment on this. And he said, don't think that Maimonides actually believes that the world is eternal in one way or the other. And he this was published in 1836 in Sudilkov, which is in Eastern Europe, and therefore it was available to a Hasidic leader, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was writing a book on philosophy in around 1842, that sort of time. And so on the next page, page 4, the last page, we've got a quote from this Hasidic leader, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, around 1840, something like that. Maimonides explained. Okay, Israel?
Maimonides explained the fact that he presents this proof, according to the words of Aristotle, in order to prove the existence of God, even according to the view of those who believe the universe is eternal, so that they could not say that this, the existence of God, could only be proved if one believes in the creation of the universe. After proving the existence of God according to all opinions, then he demonstrates with proofs the faith of the creation of the universe.
Now this is a very subtle thing, and Maimonides, in the next paragraph, talks of it, brings a summary in one or two lines of Guide 171. Maimonides makes the point that if you believe the universe was created, obviously God created it. You've got no problem about God. The problem about God is when you think that the universe is eternal. So he's trying to prove that God exists even if you think the universe is eternal. However, having written the guides and having got a lot of different kinds of feedback, Maimonides, and that's Davidson's view. Davidson's view is that having written the guide, Maimonides realized that he wasn't forthright enough in his 13 principles of faith. And that is why in a manuscript of the 13 principles of faith, in his own handwriting, he adds a footnote after he wrote the guide, 20, 30 years later. And here we have this footnote. Eddie, would you like to read it? And no. So now this, we had the fourth principle. On page one, we had the fourth principle. It said, we are to believe, it's the bottom of page one, we are to believe that the One is absolutely eternal, no thing existed before Him, as many scriptural verses prove. A dwelling place is the eternal God. He then added a footnote in the manuscript. Right? Would you?
And know?
That's it.
And know that the great fundamental...
Fundament.
...of the Torah of Moses, our teacher, is that the world is created. God formed it and created it after complete nothingness. The fact that you see that I circle around the idea of the eternity of the world...
Right, now in Hebrew,
according to the opinion of the philosophers, is in order that there should be definite proof of God's existence, as have I explained and clarified in the guide, even if you don't believe it, even if you believe in eternity.
Right. So you see, this footnote expresses Maimonides' concern that the concept of creation should be unambiguously written in to the 13 principles of faith. Unlike Albo. Albo was perfectly happy because that he didn't include it in the 13 principles of faith, being an example of almost everyone sees Maimonides in their own image, right? 19th century reform saw Maimonides as representing them. Hasidism sees Maimonides as representing them. Everyone sees Maimonides as their mascot. So whether you're a philosopher or a fundamentalist, whatever, or a fundamentalist philosopher, you can have you claim Maimonides. However, an interesting passage, just to end, is in a medical book. The last 10 years of his active life, Maimonides was writing medical works. And in one of these books, he is discussing Galen, the great physician. He was a Greek who was active in Rome, and he's one of the fathers of medicine. He did experiments, a fascinating figure. However, Galen ridiculed the Jewish concept of God and the idea of miracles. So then we have a comment about Galen by Maimonides. And it focuses on the fact that Galen is skeptical about the creation of the world. So would we like to, could you please read that? This falsifying
and inexact Galen, extremely ignorant in most things of which he speaks, except in the art of medicine, repeatedly states and explains that he is skeptical on this point, namely, the basic principle of the creation of the world, and does not know whether it is eternal or created. Therefore, he should have also been skeptical, i.e. agnostic, about miracles. Instead, he denies them completely. This shows his ignorance concerning of the adherence of the twig to the root, if only skeptical about A, one should only be skeptical about B, which derives from A.
Right, so in other words, Maimonides is saying Galen doesn't know the basic rules of logic, that if B derives from A and you're not sure about A, so you're not sure about B, but you can't categorically say B doesn't exist just because you're unsure about A. But that seems to express Maimonides' feelings about the creation of the world, and the idea that Galen, great as he was in terms of medicine, when it came to the creation of the world, he was not sure about it, and that led to other problems that he had, including not accepting the Jewish view of God and the Jewish view of miracles. So we've understood, hopefully, a little bit of insight into why Maimonides wrote a footnote many years later in his own handwritten version of the 13 Principles of Faith. Thank you.
I don't want to let this thing rest. In this footnote that he wrote, it's translated here in the second sentence, God formed it and created it after complete nothingness. Now, having spent a little time with some of the medievals, the word after does not necessarily mean after in time. After can mean after in a series of cause and effects. So it could be that there's some level of reality beyond this, and then there is a derivative level of reality where this happens. So it doesn't necessarily, it's not an absolute proof that eventually he came to embrace the idea of creation and time, I would say.
Well, I would say, sidestepping your question at the beginning, your point, I'm not suggesting that he eventually came to embrace. I think he embraced it all the time. It's only the question of how forcefully he should make the point. But you're now addressing the point that you're making, complete nothingness. I'm taking literally as complete nothingness. Complete nothingness means that what Maimonides attributed to Plato, the idea that there is a chomer hiyuli in Hebrew, some kind of primal matter existing, and that this primal matter is what God formed into existence. Now, the question is where this primal matter begins. If he says complete nothingness, now I'm hampered by not knowing the Arabic, but this is how Kapach translated it into Hebrew. I can't remember the exact word in Hebrew either, but it's but that term nothingness seems to negate the idea of primal matter.
I'm just thinking about Gersonides, who has a very compelling reading of the first chapter of Genesis in an Aristotelian way, and he shows certain nuances in the words that demonstrate very clearly, according to his argumentation, that the creation follows exactly the view of Aristotle.
Well,
and he has the idea, and he has a whole discussion. This is in Wars of the Lord.
Yes.
He has a whole discussion that when you say prior or before or after, that there are many senses of that word, and they don't necessarily mean in time.
Well, the big problem with Bereshit at the beginning is that the word Reshit is a construct.
Beginning of.
The beginning of.
So
and Rashi says, you know, the beginning of the creation, like already there's an ambiguity there leading to the possibility of Gersonides or whatever. So thank God for the Big Bang.
Even one other thing, looking at the statement by Albo on page 2, everyone is compelled to believe creation ex nihilo is a dogma, which everyone who professes the divine law is obliged to believe. And now I'm putting quotations, in the same way as he who professes the law of Moses is obliged to believe that the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up Korah, etc. As you know, there are people who take these things non-literally. The religious Jews in the Middle Ages who explain these things as allegories or something like that. So when he says that one must believe this in the same way as one believes that, then he uses the example of the earth zone. And that's, it could be, it can be read somewhat subversively to say that you have to believe that, in a sense, simple people who take things literally, they'll believe it literally, and also understand it allegorically, can understand it allegorically the same way they believe in these stories of the mouth, earth opening its mouth, they should believe in creation ex nihilo, you know.
All this fuels wonderful academic project of looking at the writings of the medieval Jewish writers, or in fact all Jewish thought all the way through, from the Bible through the Talmud and to the present, into what does it mean. And there's this wonderfully fluid approach that, first of all, you can suspect everyone of being subversive in one way or the other. Someone wrote a book about Maimonides called Politics and the Art of Writing. Okay, I don't subscribe to the views expressed by Leo Strauss in that book, but he is talking about the way in which you write something even if you don't mean what you've written. So, because
else,
of politics.
I would argue the other side. This way, you save yourself from calling everyone a heretic or saying that everyone's going to burn in hell, and you have it, you open things up in a much more flexible way that people can be part of the religion. And genuine, sincere, believing Jews, even if they don't believe in exactly the same.
That's absolutely fascinating, Israel, because there's another strategy to rescue every single Jew, is by being a total fundamentalist. The world was created in 6 days, 5,776 years ago, but even though he sinned and he didn't believe this and he's a heretic this way, the other way, he's still a Jew and eventually he will inherit the world to come. So I think that would be a very good article.
Okay, thank you.